afternoon. I'm Frank Ling, and this is the Berkeley Grok Science Show.
That's right. It's a weekly look at the world of science, technology, and their effects on our daily lives. I'm Charles Lee.
Coming up on today's show, Humvees, starvation, and the Newton Code.
In addition, we'll be joined by Dr. Rich Report, who will talk about nerve endings.
Also, we'll find out why turkey makes you sleepy.
So stay tuned for all of this, plus the Grokatron 5000 and the world-famous Question of the Week, coming right up here on Berkeley Groks.
Welcome back to Berkeley Groks. I'm Frank Ling.
And I guess that makes me Charles Lee. How you doing, Frank?
Just had an awesome Thanksgiving again this year.
I get all stuffed, you know? I mean, I'm always a little stuffed whenever I come back from Thanksgiving.
Was it the white meat or is it the dark meat?
I wasn't even eating meat. I was eating hair, I think.
Turkey hair?
Well, the tofu hair.
Oh.
We had the tofu bird, so.
Oh, of course. The hippie way of doing Thanksgiving, right?
So that and hummus, I think. The tofu bird and hummus was... I think that's what the pilgrims had when they came over.
So they could practice their own puritanical ways.
That's right.
Anyway, so not speaking of hippies or Thanksgiving or food.
Well, that's something I have to give thanks for then. What do you have to give thanks for?
How about alchemy?
Ooh.
That's a different kind of science.
I'm surprised that there are no departments of alchemy nowadays, because that's a science that I think has gone underappreciated recently.
Yeah, you know who one of the forefathers is?
Newton?
Yeah, of course.
Okay.
And in fact, some of his lost notes were recently found in the Royal Society's miscellaneous manuscripts collection in London.
So he was basically in his last days trying to turn straw into gold or
something like gold or silver. And at the time, it was actually considered a felony to do alchemy. But I guess there was a very strong interest amongst scientists at the time to create gold.
I think there is today as well.
Actually, it turns out there was some study that said that if you take all the gold that's found in the core and the mantle of the Earth and was able to extract that, we have enough to basically cover the surface of the Earth knee deep with gold.
Solves our alchemy problem then.
Yeah.
Why didn't Newton think of this? Genius like that? Calculus, yes. Gravity?
He didn't want to dig down there, huh?
I guess not.
So this note's quite interesting since it was originally sold at a Sotheby's auction in 1936 for £15, which I guess was actually a bit worth a little bit more then. But everyone thought it was missing until they found it recently. And if you look at the notes, it turns out it's actually him writing about another French chemist, Pierre-Jean Favre, scientist at the time. But the interesting thing is he also wrote some code that suggested that he had his own methodologies and his own hypotheses of alchemy.
Certainly I would imagine that.
Maybe this is the real Da Vinci code, especially because of Newton codes, huh?
It's his grand grimoire.
Anyways, if anyone is interested, well, unfortunately, I guess it's no longer on display, but it was actually on display at the Royal Society's Summer Science Exhibition. But if you had some special requests, they would probably let you still see it.
Right. Well, I think I know why Newton was trying to turn all the stuff into gold.
Because he wanted to become gold?
Well, maybe because he wanted to buy a Humvee.
A Humvee? He knew how to be in style. Didn't he also die a virgin?
Well, that's right, and he was quite proud of that as well.
Yes.
Must have had different social standards back in those days.
Yeah.
So this is actually a question of how do men actually view themselves in terms of their masculinity?
By the size of their...
car, of course, is what you're saying.
I was getting to that. Fortunately, so...
According to what a group of researchers are suggesting is that when men are actually tested as far as their masculinity goes, you put them to test and say they're feminine, men will actually, of course, back up and defend their masculinity, and as a result, drive them to stereotyping people and supporting war and buying Humvees.
So the size of my nuclear bomb does matter.
Shaped so cylindrically. I mean, this was actually going back to Freud, who would argue that people actually tend to fight back by exaggerate the threatened trait. So a group of researchers, psychologist Rob Willer at Cornell University in Ithaca, he tested this on 111 undergraduate males, gave them a personal profile test, had them look at it, and then after they answered the question, he labeled half of them feminine and half of them masculine. And the one issue was that, well, how do they actually act when threatened as far as their masculinity? What is their attitude towards things like SUVs and ban on gay marriage?
Vote Republicans.
And in fact, it looks like more of them do. So if you criticize someone being effeminate, they'll actually start acting more manly.
So George Bush must be the manliest man on the planet.
Well, or else somebody called him a sissy a long time ago.
You don't call Texas, you know.
Countries like Iraq will suffer. The interesting thing was that female students, when told the same thing, either they were more masculine or feminine, their attitudes didn't change. So they're the same across the board. One sociologist, Michael Kimmel of Stony Brook University in New York, says, well, it's pretty obvious that 20-year-old guys probably aren't very secure in their masculinity, but it'd be interesting to see how this test would work with, say, older males.
I remember there was some study carried out some time ago that suggested that there's a higher chance of war breaking out when the population has a higher percentage of young males.
Because they're all full of testosterone. So this is very cool work, and it was actually published at the recent American Sociological Association's meeting.
So, Charles, what's your hot pepper tolerance?
Well, I think on the Scoville rating, I can go up to about 1.
So does that make you a Korean?
No, I think that probably makes me bland.
So I guess you can be easily repelled with some pepper spray then, huh?
I guess I haven't driven my dates to that level of disgust.
So it turns out elephants actually do not like spicy chili peppers.
Well, I have no reason to presume a priori that they would.
So it turns out one of the recent strategies for keeping your elephants away from your crops is plant spicy chili peppers around your farm.
Uh-huh.
And that will prevent them from coming over, since the spice bothers them quite a bit.
Okay.
But anyway, so this idea is not new, actually. They've been trying to use it against rodents and other animals, buffaloes and mammals. But they realized for elephants, this is actually a very cheap way of actually warding them off.
What about mice? Aren't elephants afraid of mice? Or maybe electroshock. Again,
yeah.
a useful alternative in most things.
Although it would be kind of cool if you could actually genetically engineer the buffaloes to eat those chili peppers so that when you hunt them down and cook them, they'll be spicy buffalo wings.
Well, I don't know if you make buffalo wings out of buffaloes, but...
Am I missing something here?
I don't know. I didn't even realize buffaloes had wings. Wow. You learn something every day on this show.
Yes. Anyways, this is the latest in crop technology. So if anyone's interested, they can buy some spice from the African Spice Company in Zambia.
It's going to be a big problem in those vast cornfields of Iowa. The elephants.
Yes.
Well, maybe eating those spicy chili peppers is not such a bad idea if you want to remain sane.
So spiciness keeps me on my toes then.
It may do that. It may also make your hair stand on end. But in fact, I'm just talking about any kind of food whatsoever.
Any kind of food.
So recent studies actually shown that starvation increases the risk of schizophrenia.
Well, because this old Kung Fu master told me starvation increases your Kung Fu powers.
Well, I wouldn't doubt the old Kung Fu master. Certainly go with what he's saying. But of course, he may be crazy. So.
Oh, yes. And powerful.
Well, I mean, according to the study, which was done in China, epidemiologists have basically looked at the rate of incidence of schizophrenia during a period when food was very short in supply. And what they found essentially was that during these years of famine, the rate of schizophrenia increased in the population. And this was the same sort of thing that was seen in the Netherlands during World War II, when famine and shortages due to the World War was happening.
Wow.
So it was actually a bit of a question, because the earlier studies, they thought, well, these people were actually eating these tulips, which might have had some toxin in it. But since in China they don't have these tulips and they weren't eating, it seems as if just starvation might somehow be implicated in increasing the risk of schizophrenia.
Wow, that's pretty powerful.
So the message is, go have a burger.
I'm up for a prime rib any time.
Okay, so this is very fascinating work. It was published in the recent edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association.
JAMA.
And that's all for a look at current developments in the world of science and technology. You're listening to Berkeley Grox here on KALX 90.7 FM. Well, coming up next, Dr. Richard Rapport will join us to talk about nerve endings. So stay tuned.
Welcome back to the Berkeley Grok Science Show here on KALX 90.7 FM. Well, our brains are constructed from billions of neurons connected in a complex network that allows us to go about our lives. But the discovery of the connections between neurons is only about a century old and owes their discovery to two men, Ramon y Cajal and Camille Golgi. And the story of this discovery is outlined in a new book by Dr. Richard Rapport, who joins us today. Dr. Rapport is a neurosurgeon whose popular works include Physician, The Life of Paul Beeson. And his new book, Nerve Endings, The Discovery of the Synapse, outlines the remarkable early discoveries in the brain. Dr. Rapport, thank you very much for joining us today on Berkeley Groks.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, it's certainly a pleasure to have you on the program, and you've certainly written a very fascinating book, Nerve Endings, here, where you outline a lot of the discoveries about the connections between neurons. But I'm curious, actually, what were people's ideas about the brain before Cajal and Golgi?
Well, these, of course, began with the Greeks, these notions, and for thousands of years, the construction of the brain was based mostly on philosophical speculation. This began with Plato and Aristotle, and before there was good understanding of anatomy, much less microscopic anatomy, people simply speculated about how the brain ought to go together. Beginning in about 1800, or at least the early 19th century, microscopes got good enough so that people could begin to see the units of neural construction. And Descartes' error separating mind and body began to dissolve, and people started to wonder whether the nervous system was one entirely connected organ, which was the position championed by Golgi and most of European scientists, or whether there were individual units, which we now call neurons, separated by tiny little gaps, which Cajal eventually identified as the synapse. Synapses are important, as we'll discover, because without them, there really isn't very much ability of information to be conducted in neural tissue.
And it was Golgi, apparently, who had the first technique to actually start visualizing these neurons.
Yes, Camillo Golgi was an important scientist. He was a very good histologist. His discoveries are important not only in the nervous system, but in basic cell biology. He was a sort of a cool customer, Golgi. He was a northern Italian. He was kind of a dogmatic guy, and he was a bit reserved and maybe even insecure. He, however, did make the startling discovery that neurons could be stained with reduced silver. Before that, the problem wasn't that you couldn't see neurons and their processes. The problem was you saw too many of them. Mm. And if you stain them all, they overlap. They're a jumble. You can't tell where they go. Their outlines are very faint with traditional aniline stains. But Golgi, sort of by accident, as these things often happen, discovered that if you preserved and stained in a certain way with silver, you could outline about 1 or 2% of neurons, and you outlined them very beautifully. He, however, was deeply committed to the notion of the reticulum or network theory, and so he kind of stopped at that point.
I see, and the reticular theory was that all these neurons were continuously connected.
Right, anatomically hooked up one to another. You have to remember that Darwinism was just being proven at about the same time, and these early histologists believed that an entirely connected nervous system would give an evolutionary advantage to mammals with the biggest brains, basically us. And so they liked that idea. Networks were popular in varieties of places in those days. People thought they saw them in the heart and so on. And most of the European scientists of note up until about 1880, 1885, were very wedded to that notion.
So how did this contrast with the other main character in your book, actually, Ramon y Cajal?
Yeah, Santiago Ramon y Cajal is a wonderful character. He's well known to neuroscientists, but he's otherwise completely unknown out of Spain. And mm-hmm. he's just one of those eclectic geniuses who could sort of do anything. But he didn't begin well. He was kind of a naughty little boy. He got into lots of trouble. His father was a barber surgeon in a tiny little village in the Pyrenees in northern Spain. And he was an artistic, dreamy child who really didn't look like he was going anywhere. Then he finally went to medical school and discovered histology. He became very excited by that because he was an artistic person, and he liked looking through the microscope and drawing what he saw there. So his talents, both as a scientist and as an artist, combined very well for this task. Then, sort of by accident, he discovered Golgi's stain. And when he saw Golgi's stain, the man ignited. And in the space of a very few years, 2 or 3 years, all that Cajal did was fundamentally to describe the entire nervous system.
And this was actually sort of done in isolation from most of the rest of the scientific establishment, wasn't
it? Yeah. I'm glad to note that you actually read my book, Charles, and you read it quite carefully. Yes, one of Cajal's advantages really was that he was alone. He had no real teachers. There was almost no science in Spain of consequence, and so he was kind of isolated from the thinking of the rest of the European scientific establishment. And this he turned to an advantage without the bias of the reticular theory, and by perfecting Golgi's stains. Golgi's stain is a bit temperamental, and Cajal, who was also interested in photography, so that kind of works together, because photography is, after all, reduced silver, elemental silver. So he figured out how to perfect the stain, and then he was just dogged. I mean, he would look through his microscope for 15 hours a day, and he had the imagination and the technique by about 1886, 1887, and a couple of tricks. He used embryonic tissue, which is poorly myelinated and therefore stains better with silver. He was able to see that place where axons just barely do not contact the dendrites of the next cell. Mm-hmm. I should say at this point that the language is a little bit specialized, but the book I wrote for a general audience. This book is accessible to anybody with a basic knowledge of how science works. It's not written for neuroanatomists.
The discovery of this gap, the synapse, it pretty much revolutionized most of the neurosciences.
It did. It revolutionized not only neuroanatomy and histology, but also philosophy, certainly neurology and neurosurgery. My analogy is that if you have a wire hooked up to a light bulb and you plug the wire in, the light bulb goes on, and there's a little bit of information in that, but not really very much information. If you add a switch to the circuit and you can make it go on and off, then you got Morse code. And of course, there's an enormous amount of information there. The reticulists didn't realize that if you have electricity basically running around in a closed circuit continually, you can't really transmit much information. The synaptic spaces are the gates, and each neuron has thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of inputs. And these synaptic inputs instruct the next cell body as to what to do. So it's the total number of inputs that determine whether the next cell fires. So the basic construction of the nervous system depends upon the synapse. There are lots of diseases that are also basically synaptic diseases, things like myasthenia gravis, Parkinsonism, depression, probably Alzheimer's disease. All of these illnesses are malfunctions of synaptic transmission. The most well-studied of these is Parkinson's disease.
So the synapse, in a way, opens up the possibilities of how the brain can communicate within itself.
It does. Without that understanding, all of modern neuroscience would have gone nowhere. And in my discipline, neurosurgery, really nobody was operating on the brain itself. There were a few bold souls in the 19th century who tried to take out blood clots and infection and elevate depressed fractures and things like that. But people wouldn't operate on the brain itself because they were afraid if everything was connected, if you interrupted the circuit in some place, you might short-circuit the whole deal, sort of like a blowout in a string of Christmas tree lights disabling the entire chain.
So both men eventually were awarded the Nobel Prize for their discoveries, but I guess there was some contention at the actual award ceremony.
There was. Golgi was, as I say, a very cold Italian, northern Italian guy. Santiago Ramón y Cajal was a hot Spaniard. He was a liberal man for his day. Cajal had lots of good ideas. And when he went to receive the Nobel Prize, he was gracious. He deferred to the other people who had had a hand in all of this, and there were several, of course. Golgi did not. Golgi took the podium and began to defend what was by now a 15-year outdated theory. And And regrettably, for all of Golgi's great contributions, he's remembered largely for the size of this error. He sort of made a fool of himself, really, and everybody in the room knew it. So Golgi's contributions are sometimes belittled for that reason. Mm.
But I mean, his contributions in the rest of cell biology are still profound.
Oh, they are very profound. He discovered the reticular formation. He discovered the Golgi apparatus. He discovered the Golgi tendon organ. And he was a very talented man. In addition to that, he made contributions to the understanding of the life cycle of malaria. He became the rector of the University of Pavia, where he spent his career, and ultimately he was elected to the Italian Senate. Golgi was a man of enormous talent. He also had huge human failings, and the human failings for him were obstacles that he really never overcame.
Hmm. After the ceremony, these two men, I guess, never actually talked to each other again.
No, that was the only time they met. It was a great regret to Cajal. Cajal felt badly about this. He actually did realize what Golgi had done, not only for himself, but for all of neuroscience, and he deeply regretted that they never got by it. Golgi retreated to Italy. He didn't travel much. He was about 10 years older than Cajal. They never solved it, and it was really a tragedy in the lives of both men that they couldn't.
We're getting a little out of time, but you do mention Cajal was a bit of a colorful character. What are some of the more interesting stories about Cajal and his life?
Well, when he was about 10 years old, he and his village mates, this again is in a tiny little town in northern Spain, found a long beam, a wooden beam. They managed to drill a hole down the center of it with an auger, and then they constructed a cannon. They found some powder. They loaded this thing up on the garden gate and aimed it at the neighbor's gate and blew a gigantic hole in the wall. They were all quickly arrested for this by the constable, and Cajal, actually at the age of 11 years, was thrown in jail for 3 days. So he was a naughty little boy. He got into trouble, but he was very inventive. He was a naturalist from the time he was 8 or 9 years old. He was a wonderful artist. He drew, he painted, and of course, eventually he got over it. He got through his adolescence, and he became one of the most important scientists ever in Spain, in my opinion, and his contributions to neuroscience for the world were enormous.
Mm. A lot of people in the neurosciences, as you point out, almost view him on par with what Einstein did in physics. Why do you think he's not as well known outside of just the field?
Well, because he was Spanish, number one. Mm. Number two, he was never a self-promoter. And number three, when he finally had to go to Germany to prove what he had discovered. Mm. He did it very quickly at a meeting of the German Anatomical Society in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory of the neuron and the synapse was then almost immediately universally accepted. So lots of people got working on this right away. And he had a brief moment of great fame. But as I say, he didn't promote himself particularly. And the theory was so universally accepted that it just kind of took off on its own. And he was a bit forgotten outside of neuroscience.
All right. Well, I guess when you're right, you're right.
He was definitely correct.
Okay. Dr. Rapport, it looks like we are slightly out of time, but I do want to thank you for joining us today on Berkeley Grocks and, of course, talking about all the fascinating things with nerve endings.
Thank you very much for calling me. I appreciate it.
And you were just listening to Dr. Richard Rapport discussing nerve endings. You're listening to the Berkeley Grocks Science Show here on KALX 90.7 FM. Well, coming up next is the Grokatron 5000 and the world-famous question of the week. So stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Berkeley Grok Science Show. Well, we're back from the break, and Dr. Richard Rapport has graciously decided to stick around and play our game, the Grokatron 5000. The Grokatron 5000 is, of course, our supercomputer, which was formerly known as Deep Blue. And today, the Grokatron 5000 has chosen the topic Golgi or Cajal. So for the following five people, the Grokatron 5000 would like to know, are they more like Golgi or Cajal? Dr. Rapport, you ready to play your game?
I'm absolutely prepared.
Okay, very good. Golgi or Cajal, number one, the governator himself, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Oh, my goodness. I'm not sure he would be very like either of them, but I suppose just because of his flamboyance, I would have to say Cajal.
Okay. Pumping people up is certainly along those lines.
Yeah.
Number two, the famed director Steven Spielberg.
I don't know much about Spielberg, but I think probably Golgi. Spielberg seems a bit reserved to me.
Certainly his films aren't, though.
Yeah, no, that's true.
All right. Number three, preeminent sky psychologist B.F. Skinner.
Skinner, I think, comes down on the Golgi side. He was a bit dogged, and he was awfully committed to his own ideas. Putting your own child in a box to raise him strikes me as a little peculiar even now.
A little excessive, I think.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, number four, Oprah Winfrey.
That's another tough one. Just because of her persona, I think she would come down on the Cajal side.
Flamboyant, huh?
Right.
And finally, number five, the President of the United States, George Bush.
Do I have to answer this? I don't think George Bush is like anybody, and I think I'm going to leave that one blank.
Okay. And Dr. Rapport, I do want to thank you very much for joining us today on the Berkeley Grok Science Show, talking about your book, Nerve Endings.
Thank you, Charles. I've enjoyed it very much.
Okay, thank you.
And Forrest here with the answer to last week's question of the week. Why does turkey make me so sleepy? Well, turkey contains tryptophan amino acid, and when it goes into your body, it breaks down and becomes serotonin, which is a mood-relaxant chemical, and that's why you get so sleepy.
Whoa, it's like surfer dying, man. I'm like on amphetamines, right? None of that tryptophan's gonna slow me down, buddy. Whoa, whop out! Well, you know what's gonna happen? When you take the amphetamines, well, if you know the answer, think you know the answer. Hey, dude, emails at grox@hotmail.com. You ain't gonna win anything, but damn, you're just gonna see the colors.
And that's all for this week's edition of Berkeley Groks.
Make sure you tune in next week for more from the world of science and technology.
If you'd like to contact us for Berkeley Groks, you can email us at grox@hotmail.com. For Berkeley Groks, I'm Frank Ling.
And I'm Charles Lee. Make sure you also see us on the web at www.grox.net. Have a great afternoon and stay tuned for more music.